Oi, oi, it's your boy, Slacky Claws, or Father Slackmas, depending on what side of the Atlantic you're on. I had already clocked off for Christmas. I said, yep, that'll do me for the year. I'll come, or, you know, maybe not the year, maybe I come back on New Year's Eve or something like that. But then I remembered that, like, the biggest heavyweight fight of the year since the last Usyk Fury fight was happening over the weekend. So I had to get off my ass and watch that. And I thought I'd share some thoughts on it because it was a really good fight. And then I was watching the Glory versus Rise card as well, which I haven't finished, but I need to chat about some of that too. So, yeah, lots of stuff going on when I thought there wasn't. The Fury versus Usyk card, I had a very hard time getting motivated to watch it in the first place, which is part of why I was like, ah, that'll do me for the year, because I just am bored of Tyson Fury. I was very skeptical when he came in and weighed in 20 pounds heavier than last time. Someone asked me about it, and I said, well, he weighed in 20 pounds heavier. He's almost 40 years old. That's not 20 pounds of muscle. I mean, even if he weren't 40 years old, that wouldn't be 20 pounds of muscle. But, you know, you're not going to be putting on tons of muscle at that age. I think he's actually only 36, because Usyk's older than him. Usyk's 38, which is even more incredible, because he's got a movement-based style. Generally, athletes are lasting longer nowadays, partly because we can, like, replace ACLs and things. Though there's another school of thought that there's, like, people didn't used to get ACL'd all the time in the old days anyway. There's people out there who think, like, the way we focus on strength and conditioning in terms of, like, making athletes stronger all the time might be setting them up for injury. But this is not a strength and conditioning podcast, because my strength and conditioning is arse. He weighed in 20 pounds heavier, Fury, and I was very skeptical about that. I thought he was probably going to try and cash out, maybe just, you know, maybe he's done. But I thought he gave a good account of himself. He gave a better account of himself than last time. Scorecards, I'll just be up front. I didn't bother scoring it. I was just watching it and enjoying it. So I'm not going to give you, like, my strong opinion on anything. I saw people saying that Tyson Fury had been robbed. I think even if you feel like he deserved to win, I don't think he was robbed. It wasn't a particularly... You know, robbed means that something's obvious. I don't know. Well, we fucking do this every week on this podcast because we're an MMA podcast, and in MMA, people just cannot get over calling things robberies. But yes, you probably could have scored it to Fury if you really wanted to. But to my eye, just the whole fight, I think, summed up for me, which is what I used to do in articles. But if I were writing an article about this, I'd say that I felt like Fury was trying to trap him and come up with ideas, and it led to some moments in the fight, like minutes at a time, where he was doing very interesting things that looked like they could be trouble for Fury, for Usyk, and then he'd move on to something different. Whereas Usyk was scoring all the time. He was just, I mean, he looked like a guy with 350 amateur fights and 30 pro fights or whatever it is, like just an insane number of fights against an insane number of people, body styles, and he goes out there and he makes his points. There was no point in this fight where Tyson Fury stopped the left straight to the body or the jab to the body from landing. He hadn't an answer to that. He landed maybe one good counter uppercut late in the fight off an attempted left straight to the body by Usyk. But those two pokers just keep landing. And I think that was something that I felt watching this fight. I just had this thought that Usyk wins fights in very, I'm going to say basic, but fundamental styles, but with techniques that people don't use. Just, you know, think of the number of boxers you can name off the top of your head who really respect the jab and the left straight to the body. Because those are, like, big amateur punches. And I believe he started his amateur career when they were still electronic scoring, and a big portion of it was under that. But those are scoring punches. Those are punches that, in an amateur fight, mean as much as a good punch to the head. But when you're talking about heavyweights and professional boxing, it's all absolutely focused on the head. Or if it's to the body, it's big rips. You've got to get close enough, you've got to drop your hands, and you've got to swing hard to the body. And Usyk, those punches never look weak, the jab and the left straight. And I do always think that it's impressive that even against these enormous... Well, Fury's 100% the biggest opponent he's ever faced. But even against these enormous heavyweights with big reaches, he manages to get just to the point where his left straight is straightening out right into their belly, where his jab is straightening out right into their belly. It never looks too crowded. He never looks like he's smothering his power by stepping in too close. He never looks like he's overreaching. His distancing is perfect for it. But those two shots, the jab to the body and the left straight to the body, not only do they score him tons of points and mean that he's always landing, there wasn't a minute in this fight where he wasn't landing a few good punches. They set up the left straight and the left overhand over the top, which is the most basic setup in the world, but it's still working on Tyson Fury, who's probably like the best technician at heavyweight, aside from Usyk. You know, amongst the big heavies, he's the technical one. And he's still getting tricked both fights with the jab, jab, jab to the body, jab overhand. And by the like sixth, seventh, eighth round, Usyk comes out and goes jab, body, overhand immediately at the start of each round. So I felt like consistency was probably the key to Usyk winning this one. Because Fury had some really good moments. It was just that Usyk was always scoring. And Fury was like taking his time to work out what he wanted to do next. And I think this has been a criticism of Fury, of mine, for a little while. Like, he gets an idea, he tries the idea, maybe the idea stops working briefly, and then he won't return to the idea. It was really obvious in the, oh, it must have been the first Usyk fight, the uppercut he started finding in the middle of the fight. I think it was only like one or two rounds. He's landing this right uppercut beautifully. And then something just puts him off it, and he never goes back to it. Now, I can get, like, if you get clipped with a good counterpunch, and you go, well, that's the danger. You know, he's hit me with a left hook or a left overhand as I'm throwing the right uppercut. That's the danger of throwing the right uppercut. But then you go, okay, well, we've got to get him off, get his mind off that, get his finger off the trigger on that counter, and then later in the fight, I'll try and drop an uppercut in again. But he doesn't really do that. He just goes, right, next idea. Which is cool, like, as a, you know, as a martial artist myself, I'm sure boxers will hate hearing that, you know, boxing is a martial art. But as someone who trains a lot myself, I like tricks. I like having a bag of tricks. I like things that surprise people. And I think Fury got too into that. Because a lot of these fights, he's been able to just get behind his jab and be the better fighter consistently. And I think in here, he's with a fighter who's as good as him. And he's outpointing him by volume and gas tank and pace. And he's looking for big moments and getting caught up in that. What I really liked was from Fury, we'll talk about some of those moments, the jab, he was using it to double up, pumping the jab twice. I'm very interested how he wraps his hands or how he has his hands wrapped, because he, like Ali, if you watch some of those replays where he throws the 1-2 and it's a real short right straight down the center that lands, but he'll throw the jab with his wrist bent, basically, backhanding Usyk's lead hand and then throw the right straight. And his hand's completely bent. It's like the point of hand wraps for most people is that it stops your hand from bending when your hand connects with something at high pace, you know, a decent force when someone's stepping in, because that's how you really hurt yourself. If you've never punched a bag without wraps on, and then you punch a bag without wraps on and you've never done it before, the first thing that goes wrong is probably your wrist buckling. And if that doesn't happen, try it on like one of those, if you've ever seen one of those crappy wall bags that's like a shield with a jutting out top bit, or a Mexican, is it called a Mexican bag? One of those bags that has the wider top that comes in so that you can target uppercuts at it. Throw an uppercut without wraps on and your wrist will immediately buckle if you've never done it before. So your hand wraps are supposed to stop that. So it was quite interesting watching Tyson Fury's wrist just flap around freely in his glove. So then I'm wondering, like, but he throws his right hand with stank and he's whipping his left hand out like Ali used to call it, snake licking. Loose hand in the glove, backhanding them. And I'm thinking, does he wrap his right hand tighter? what's going on there? But then the other look I really liked with his jab, you know, doubling up the jab, he'd go jab, left hook as well. But when Usyk stepped out, or he would step towards Usyk with his jab, put his lead foot straight forward, and Usyk would try and step around outside it and slide off to the outside angle. So Fury would jab as he stepped in, and then he'd pull his lead hand back and throw a wide, slappy left hook. Had to be arm, and it had to come back like Todd Duffy throwing that punch at Frank Mir. You know, he had to come out to the side. Because when you step past someone's lead foot and lead shoulder, you make it very hard for them to hook you hard with good body mechanics. But you can, like, still throw your hand around like a slap. And he was catching Usyk with that time and time again. And a few times he then got some combinations off it, which worked really well. But if you watch round six, round seven, he's just jabbing in, and then as Usyk steps around the corner, he slaps him with the left hook around the gloves, and it catches Usyk basically every time. And Usyk's got his gloves, you know, he's got his forearms up when he does that. The left uppercut in the fifth round was gorgeous. I mean, that was a punch that he threw once in the fight, I think, and stunned Usyk, and that really let him go to work in the, was that the late fifth round? The other one that I really liked, and Tyson Fury's southpaw stance has always been a bit of a, like something he pulls out one round at a time for a gimmick. I think, was it Chisora? Second time he fought him, he fought almost exclusively southpaw. But against the southpaw Usyk, he actually had some good success. If you watch the later rounds especially, he'll get into an exchange with Usyk, or Usyk will enter and hit him. And it made me think about a gate swinging open. But he'd like keep his stance, but his left foot would swing back from in front of him to about 8 o'clock so that he'd be in a southpaw stance. And then he'd throw some punches from there and land. And from southpaw, he was landing loads of stuff, particularly when he went to southpaw, like sort of fleeing the exchange. But it was a double-edged sword because I've noticed Fury's defense from southpaw is not nearly as good. You know, if someone came out throwing big overhands at Fury, an orthodox opponent, against him orthodox, he'd just roll him off behind his lead shoulder. When he went southpaw, he was getting dinged with overhand lefts that he just wasn't reacting to or wasn't getting to. So that was quite interesting. It was a trade-off. He'd go to southpaw in an exchange to land a few punches, but then he might get dinged. But if you watch the latter half of the fight, a lot of his best work is by going to southpaw when under fire. I thought the reffing was also interesting in this one because when he came in 20 pounds heavier, I was like, you know, I think a lot of people thought, well, he's going to lean on him then. And Usyk, to his credit, been a lot better than a lot of heavyweights at not just stalling out clinches, but like keeping his arms tight, keeping his posture up, not letting these heavyweights lean on him. I think that's something that as a, you know, a light heavyweight or a cruiserweight coming up, perhaps you put more stock in that. Andy Ruiz is not ever making light heavyweight, but you know, he's a big fat guy, but he's not really a heavyweight. If you look at like his, he's a heavyweight because he's fat. He's not like Tyson Fury is never making. I mean, I shouldn't have to say that. It's a ridiculous statement, but Tyson Fury, AJ, Dillian White, people like that, they're never making light heavyweight or cruiserweight. And I think those fighters just get used to throw big bombs, lean on each other. And Ruiz has had great success with this, but Usyk has also had some success with this by like, you don't let them clinch. Or when they clinch, you keep your hands tight to you so that you're nice, you've got inside position on them. So they're never actually able to hold you properly, like if they had an underhook. And you just chill and then they go, okay, well, we're breaking now. And if the ref hasn't said break, you just chin them. Or you can push him away and chin him. So Usyk's impressed me with his ability to stop Fury from clinching him. But this brings me on to what I was going to say, which is the refereeing in this fight was quite interesting. The ref, when they did tie up, was having none of it. This was Kenny Bayless style. Like, you know, if you grip the guy, if you throw your arms around the guy, that's a clinch and that's a break. Whereas the second Wilder fight, and the third one, but mainly the second one, Fury is just all over Wilder. He's pulling him into clinches and then he's snapping him down and leaning on the back of his head. And the referee's just letting him. And that's not me complaining because that's, you know, this is one of the things we always talk about, the gray areas of boxing. These things are up to the ref's interpretation, which can be sketchy if you choose, if you're choosing the ref or pressuring for the right ref. But another example of it from Fury getting a positive was if you saw him throwing that, he'll throw his right hand and then he'll bring it back as a back fist or a tattoo. You know, it's not really a back fist because it's with the hammer fist portion of the hand, but backhanding is illegal. And Usyk literally looks at the ref and shows him the motion of the backhand. He breaks away from the exchange and goes, excuse me. And the ref just ignores him. So he's letting Fury back fist all fight, or backhand all fight. So a little bit of swings and roundabouts there. But then if you're Fury, you would rather be able to clinch this man freely without being punished or broken. You know, you want to be able to waste some time more than you want to be able to backhand. But when the decision came in, Usyk wins. Frank Warren made a tit of himself. Daniel Dubois. People said Daniel Dubois. People got really angry at Daniel Dubois. I think he is autistic. And I'm not saying that in like a, you know, making fun of him way. I think he has trouble with social stuff. But also, like, as we found out with Colby Covington, a lot of people fucking suck on the mic. A lot of people who are good at fighting suck at talking. And they'll never make any money out of fighting because fighting unfairly biases the money towards people who can talk or at least make people hate them. So whoever's job it was or whoever decided to tell Daniel Dubois, get up there, you know, make some hype for the rematch, it kind of fell flat on its face. But bring back the pro wrestling style manager. Get Jim Cornette out of retirement and just have him talk for Daniel Dubois. Paul Bearer is dead, isn't he? Yeah, and Jimmy Hart. I wonder if Jimmy Hart might still be alive. But yeah, get him a mouthpiece. Because Colby tried it. He had a Chael Sonnen talk for him in his last fight. And it was too late in the day. Everyone knows he's washed and he was going to lose anyway. But had he done that earlier, it might have worked better because people like seeing Chael Sonnen. People don't care about Colby Covington. Preparing lines like the seventh layer of hair or whatever it was. I'll go see your father in the seventh layer of hair. Just tripping over his fucking tongue like a Habsburg. Too big for his head. Yeah, what can you say? Usyk, I've been so impressed with him, but I've also just sort of let it slip under my radar. When you weigh up the achievements, you might be talking about an all-time great. Maybe not an all-time great heavyweight, but an all-time great of the sport to go from cruiserweight and win the heavyweight title. Anyone who goes like light heavyweight to heavyweight or cruiserweight to heavyweight and wins the belt, you've got to consider them something very special because it's not just going up 10, 15 pounds. It's, some of these divisions, it's going up like 5 pounds to get another belt. It's going up infinite because the heavyweight division is anyone, or rather any weight. And he beat AJ twice and he beat Fury twice. That's the two best heavyweights of this generation. You could say Wilder is missing from his resume, but Wilder has just sort of fallen off. There are other good heavyweights out there. There's Joseph Parker. There's Ruiz has fallen off too, hasn't he? But, the rematch with Dubois they can do. It is sort of like this should be the sort of ending to the story because that's the best fighter he's met. Or certainly the best heavyweight he's met. Second time, did it again. You could happily walk off into the sunset. But he's making me learn about Ukrainian history. He was walking around with a sword that was apparently the sword of someone famous from 300 years ago. So I've got a comment saved so I can go and check who that is and read the wiki. Seems like a great guy. Did his post-fight interview and was shouting out his kids for getting their judo belts that weekend. And no matter how many times I hear, I am where he feel. I love it. It is, charisma is one of those things like being funny. I think you're going to see a lot of this, like, now that we're in, now that you Americans are in another Trump administration, I think you're going to see a lot of the comedians who complained that they were being cancelled by woke people for the last 4 years. And you're going to realize that they just weren't funny. Because if you are funny, you can say basically anything and it's funny. It's like charisma. You can write pretty good lines or pretty shocking lines, like the Colby Covington saying he's going to see Leon Edwards' dad in hell or whatever. If you can't deliver them, and if you can't deliver them with charisma, it doesn't matter. So Usyk can barely speak English, but he's got the Riz. Riz Farmer. First time I've ever used the term the Riz, and I remembered how much I hate it. But he's got charisma. And then Daniel Dubois, who speaks perfect English, does not have charisma. But if you look at Usyk, he is like the epitome of what you should want from a champion. As much as I don't care, if someone is like breaking the law all the time out of the ring, blah, blah, blah. If the fights are good, I'm pretty good at not caring what they're up to outside the ring, because there's so many trash people in MMA promotion and in every aspect of fight sports. But if you are one of those people who's like, that's what a champion should be. Usyk won the belt at cruiserweight, could have been the best cruiserweight forever, went up to heavyweight because he was like, well, this is the thing, like, nowadays you don't need to go up to heavyweight if you're the light heavyweight champion of the world or the cruiserweight champion of the world. They've just brought in Bridgerweight after Usyk moved up even, but you don't need to because you can still make millions of dollars as the best cruiserweight in the world. It used to be in the old days when, like, Tommy Loughran was trying to fight Primo Carnero at heavyweight. It was used to be that, like, there was a stratospheric difference in the money. I mean, I suppose there is still a stratospheric difference in the money because this was supposed to be I saw it being reported that it was $190 million per split between them. And I don't think Usyk was making half of $190 million for the best fighter cruiserweight. So, he still could have not done this and been a very rich man. What I'm saying is, like, I consistently underrate Usyk in my head. And then when I stop and think about it, I go, like, damn, am I actually watching one of those all-time great runs and just not acknowledging it? But what's next for Usyk? Probably Dubois, who cares? He's the best. Whatever happens is people coming to him now. For Fury, even though this could have been cashing out, he has two easy fights on the table. Not easy fights, but two easy paydays. Him versus AJ. When people were saying there was no reason for it to not happen, there was. Neither one wanted to lose their belts. Now, neither has a belt. But the big money is in that match. So if you did AJ versus Fury at Wembley, 2025, you're going to sell out Wembley. You're going to sell out, you know, you're going to sell huge amounts of pay-per-view. Even if people think AJ's lost it after losing to Dubois. But not only can you do one, but you've got a built-in payday with a second. So 2026, you do the rematch. And if you can work the judges into it and have it go one way and then the other, you've got a third match in there. You know, that is printing money, and now there is literally no reason to stop, you know, to not do it, because neither one has anything to lose. So watch that not happen, and just that huge pile of hypothetical money that's easy to reach out and take just evaporate into the air. So what else did I watch? I was watching a bit of the Glory versus Rise featherweight tournament. It was technically a Glory event, but I think Rise also showed it. And I did ask, was this like good like a Rise event or stinky and full of injuries like a Glory event? And people generally told me it was like a Rise event. But it was won by the Glory champion, Petch Panamrung, who they just call Petch. But there's so many Petches out there anyway. But there was loads on this card. I haven't watched Kazuki Osaki's fight. I haven't watched a couple of the tournament bouts. What I made sure to do was to watch Petch's fights and Miguel Trindade's fights, who got to the final with Petch. And I'll tell you what is funny about this. This is the Glory featherweight division. So it's for the Glory Rise featherweight Grand Prix. But in Rise terms and K1 terms, it's super lightweight. So it's just all over the map with these fucking weights. But I was really impressed with Petch. I'd seen him fight maybe once before. People did sort of turn on him because he did a lot of clinching in two of his bouts. And this is supposed to be a sport that doesn't allow clinching. It's an odd one, because when have you seen it overturned? The only one I can think of is Petch Morakot versus Giorgio Petrosian, because that was one championship who will just overturn decision, you know, fights on a whim because they can and do. And because Giorgio Petrosian was like a huge star and came in and lost to this random Thai dude. Random Thai dude is reductive. Petch Morakot is very good. But, you know, like, people who watch one championship, or a lot of people, am I going to offend anyone? A lot of people who are into one championship or watch one championship really only care about, like, you know, how they were doing, like, they've got 88 world champions under their banner or whatever. They care about big names, big accomplishments, coming in, being the best, whatever. You know, that it's like, here's Mikey Musumeci, here's Giorgio Petrosian, here's so-and-so. They could be called the best to ever do it in their sport, you know. And that immediately blew up when Petrosian lost to Petch Morakot in a run-of-the-mill decision, but there was a lot of clinch kneeing. But that's about the only time I've seen it overturned. Boakow used to beat people up in the clinch in K1, so they tightened up the enforcement of the clinching rules, because clinching rules have always been pretty strict in K1. That's the point of kickboxing. It's supposed to not be Muay Thai. But then Overeem came in, and if you watch his fight with Remy Bojanski, he just throws him. Like, he's just running into clinches and throwing him on his head. And he wins the fight. And then they were like, we really need to crack down on this. Most of the time, it's like, if a fight is going to be very clinch heavy or ends up very clinch heavy, your best hope is that next time they're cracking down on it, the refs are a bit more strict on it. But Trindade, I think people are annoyed at Petch because he made a boring fight with Trindade, or like he did boring stuff in a fight with Trindade, who had been pretty amazing. This guy was having like the Andy Risty tournament run. He fought Kenta Haraguchi in the first round, who's the Rise something champion, but he's a good guy. He's ranked like top 10 in the world by Combat Press and Beyond Kick in their division. He'd never been stopped, and Trindade knocked him out. Spark, like, incredible. That was a really weird fight because Trindade is orthodox, Haraguchi's southpaw. But I would say one in every two attacks Trindade made was with a switch step to start. So he'd switch step into a southpaw right hook or a southpaw left overhand and then throw a combination. So or like sometimes he'd throw 1-1-2. He'd just throw like a sharp 1-2 stepping down the outside of the lead leg, as you would expect against a southpaw. But almost half the time he stepped in, he switched to southpaw to try and land from there, which was very weird. But he missed a left hook. I think Haraguchi went under it or pulled away from it, but he missed it and he was way off balance. And everything this lad does is so fast that I'm going back to watch it. I'm going, oh, wow, what did he do there? Oh, switch step into left overhand into right, into left low kick from southpaw. But he misses this left hook, spins through on a back fist immediately. And then after the back fist lands against the guard, he throws the left high kick, which is real tricky. I love the spinning back fist into the high kick off the same side. That's something that Sean O'Malley does. And I really like it because if you hit the guard, there's a good chance that you, like, if the opponent gets the forearm up high, there's a good chance that the force of you backhanding them, with spinning back fisting them, pulls their guard round so that the left high kick can sneak in behind it. And if you miss them altogether, say they lean back or they duck this back fist and they're coming back in on you, good chance you high kick them coming in. So it actually, while it seems like, why would you do two big techniques to the exact same spot, one after the other? I've seen it work quite well because of that. Particularly O'Malley. O'Malley does it in like almost every fight. But he didn't stun him here. It was the fact that Haraguchi went, right, two big techniques in a row. He was off balance when he missed the left hook. Then he threw a back fist that didn't work. And then he threw a high kick immediately after that didn't work. Surely it's my turn to enter now. And as he steps in to kick, he just gets banged with a right straight on the chin and goes, like, it was one of those ones where he's on one leg and that can be a knockdown, even if it's not like stunned the guy, but his head bounced off the mat and you were going, okay, he's done. And then second round, Trindade gets Chad Collins, who I've seen a lot of, actually. I like Chad Collins, but he knocked him out in a previous fight, I think in the second round. This one, two knockdowns in like a minute, basically. Chad Collins backs him up to the ropes, throws a right body kick. Trindade takes it on his left forearm and throws a left hook so fast, stuns Chad Collins, chases him to the ropes, left hook to the head, left hook to the body, knocks him down. And then as Collins gets up, he goes left hook to the body, left hook to the head, right knee. Oh, love it. Left hook to right knee is just a beauty, a peach of a combination. One of my favorites ever, Hayato Mahasakurai against Jens Pulver. He goes right straight, left hook to the body, right knee to the head as Pulver's like folding in half from the left hook to the body. And then I think he stomped him on the ground a couple of times too. It was brutal. Bushido Grand Prix Mahasakurai, one of my favorite iterations of a fighter ever. And sort of the prototype of Demetrius Johnson. If you're big into your Demetrius Johnson, Sakurai was, aside from Rich Franklin, Sakurai was like the best fighter Matt Hume had worked with at that point. And he basically reinvigorated Sakurai's career by teaching him to kickbox in a style that was quite similar to DJ. There you go. I'm always slagging off Matt Hume, one championship, rules and regs guy, shady vice president. But I have a lot of respect for Matt Hume, pioneer of MMA, who was too good back in the day, too technical for people to understand, and produced a lot of good fighters as a coach. So worth a watch, or I'm saying the fights that I saw were worth a watch. I've still got to watch Tenshin's little brother. I've got to watch all the little fights in between, and I've got to watch half the tournament. So stuff to be looking forward to. That's going to be me on my laptop midway through Christmas Day. Once all the toys have been opened by the family, I'll just be like, okay, Slacky's going to sit in the corner for a bit now. Or post-Christmas Christmas lunch. That's always the time that you get to, everyone just sort of goes, ooh, and sits down for a while. So not quite the end of the year yet. We won't do like my year end, you know, sum up of the year. Or do I normally do that? But I won't do that now. But yeah, you know, happy Christmas. Have a great holiday with your family. And thanks for supporting the podcast. And, you know, I feel like I found this year a lot more fun than I have the last couple. And I think that happened while the UFC was also still doing kind of crap stuff a lot of the time. You know, I just, finding fun fights, it's reinvigorated me. You know, going to Rise, I was going to say Glory, but most of the time they don't have fun fights. Going to Rise, going to Boxing, going to Rising, and even watching the PFL. Like, that last PFL card was so good, and it shouldn't have been. But, you know, there are good fights everywhere. You just got to scout them out. Lots of fun stuff planned for the new year, so we'll get back to it after we've celebrated some time off with you and yours. And I'm not doing the happy holidays woke thing, but, you know, obviously a lot of people listening to the podcast aren't going to be celebrating Christmas. So, you know, whatever you're doing with your family, have great fun, mate. I'm your boy, Jack Slack. You're my boy. And I will catch you in a few days. And I'll be audibly fatter. Oh, have a great one. banging on tong tinglers, blowing flu flounders, crashing jing janglers, and bouncing boing bounders. Bless.